and Sanders.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm here to represent the appellant in this case, Lamar Sanders. And today, I will be addressing 2 points raised in our briefs. First, the district court erred in admitting Tamika Noble's identifications of Lamar Sanders because those identifications were the product of an unnecessarily suggestive photo show-up and also unreliable. Second, the district court erred when it sentenced Mr. Sanders under a 25-year mandatory minimum instead of under a 20-year mandatory minimum. I'll begin now with Ms. Noble's identifications at trial. On January 5th, 2008, police officers arrested Ralph Scott in connection with at a currency exchange in connection with an attempted kidnapping and extortion scheme. They searched Mr. Scott's car, the car he was driving, which actually belonged to Mr. Sanders, and found a stack of photographs of Mr. Sanders, as well as Mr. Sanders' wallet and his driver's license. Now, at this point, the crime was over. Police had Mr. Scott in custody, and the victims of this scheme, Ms. Nobles and her 10-year-old daughter, were safe at the currency exchange together with dozens of police officers. The police also had Mr. Sanders' name, his address, and his pictures, which is all they needed to create a photo lineup to show to Ms. Nobles.
What difference did it make? They had him identified all kinds of other ways anyway. The girl, the victim, the little girl identified him. There are all these telephone calls. He's using the other fellow's car. What more do you need?
Well, Your Honor, there were certain problems. Responding first to the identification by Ms. Noble's 10-year-old daughter, there were certain problems with that identification. Ms. Noble's daughter was 10 years old at the time and in a very frightening and stressful situation. During the time, she was either in another room than Mr. Sanders, During that time, she was either in another room than the suspect or partially blindfolded. Also, during trial, a number of evidence was presented that Ms. Noble's daughter made certain mistakes at trial. Specifically, she told police officers early on in her identification that Mr. Sanders stopped, or that the suspect stopped at a gas station at 83rd and King and went inside to pay. However, the defense introduced evidence that of that video evidence inside that gas station, which did not show someone that looked like Mr. Sanders. With regards to the phone records, the phone records only show that Mr. Sanders' phone was used during the alleged scheme, not that Mr. Sanders was using it. Out of those records, there were about 26 calls between Mr. Sanders' phone and Mr. Scott. That does not show that Mr. Sanders was using the phone, only that the other person involved in the scheme was using the phone. On that day, it's uncontroverted that Mr. Sanders lent his car to Ralph Scott and that Mr. Sanders had left a number of personal items in the car, including his wallet and his driver's license.
And he used Scott's car, didn't he? Exchange cars, as I understand it.
I do not believe so, Your Honor. It's uncontroverted that Mr. Sanders' car was used by Mr. Scott, and that someone else used Mr. Scott's car, but not that Mr. Sanders was using it.
Okay.
And a jury could have found that Mr. Sanders left his phone in the car, and a second suspect, in turn, used that phone during the commission of the crime. Now, showing Ms. Nobles the stack of photos of Mr. Sanders was unnecessarily suggestive. This court has held that such photo show-ups are inherently suggestive and prone to unreliable and mistaken.
In what way have we established that? We have a string of cases in the last 5 years saying that suggestiveness is a question of cognitive psychology. And what you need to decide it is evidence about psychology. There's now an elaborate literature on the psychology of eyewitness identification. And we have been saying pretty consistently over the last 5 years that people have got to come forward with arguments based on that evidence rather than just with lawyer's certitude. So I looked in your brief and found none. I looked in the prosecutor's brief and found none. All we've got here is lawyers' beliefs, which so far as I know have no basis whatsoever. And of course your problem is, as we, if we're just choosing lawyers' beliefs, we go with the district judge's belief and not yours. But are you concretely relying on any evidence from the psychology of eyewitness ID? Huge field of science.
Your Honor, we did not cite any psychology of witness identification studies. What we did cite was prior cases which upheld that show-ups where only one suspect is shown to the witness are inherently suggestive.
You know, the Supreme Court last year had one of these eyewitness ID cases, and it dropped a couple of footnotes which said roughly, the American Psychological Association tells us that some of the language in our earlier cases is so much hogwash and has been disproved. We plan to look again at that as soon as we have a new opportunity. Well, maybe this case could provide them the opportunity, except there's no social science evidence in it.
Well, under the current Supreme Court law, in Perry versus New Hampshire, it is still the law that the courts will look at the suggestiveness of the...
That unnecessarily suggestive IDs that are likely to lead to irreparable misidentification. By the way, you ignore the second part of that requirement. Lead to suppression. But there's no law on the question what irreparable IDs are. What the Supreme Court has done is list a bunch of factors to consider. And in the case last year, the court said, well, even our list of things to consider may be wrong. But the court hasn't held that as a matter of law, if factors A, B, and C are present and D, E, and F are not, that leads to suppression. It's an issue that has to be resolved in each case. And that's where we've been saying, you know, you've got this list of factors from the Supreme Court, maybe the wrong list, but we have to consider that list now. But in considering how it works, you know, we need evidence-based law, just like we have evidence-based medicine, or at least I hope we have evidence-based medicine. Why don't we have evidence-based law?
Your Honor, I think what we did point out, maybe this goes more to it, is that this photo show-up was suggestive, and one of the reasons is because it resulted in a identification of a witness who is not accurate, who is just not described by the witness, and also where the witness was totally unreliable of her identification. Before she saw the photos...
That's just your assertion. That's my problem. I don't know whether she was totally unreliable.
And here are the factors, Your Honor, that shows her unreliability. Before she was shown the photos, early in the investigation, she described the suspect as 5'5", 250 pounds, and shorter than Ralph Scott, who was the second man in the apartment. However, Mr. Sanders is, in fact, 5'10", 180 pounds.
You know, there is... As I say, there is a very large literature in cognitive psychology asking questions like, if you ask people for a verbal description of somebody, a stranger, how accurate is that verbal description? And does an inaccurate verbal description mean that the person couldn't be identified from his face? The answer is, so far as I understand that literature, it is the verbal descriptions are very inaccurate, and that inaccuracy is not related to the probability of successful identification looking at a face. Now, that may be good or it may be bad, but it just can't be ignored.
Like I said, Your Honor, we didn't cite any psychological studies in this brief. We went through the certain factors. Something to consider, aside from just the differences in the height and weight which she described, was that she physically described described him as both short and heavy set. So not only was she off in the actual dimensions of the description, but also in her more subjective descriptions of the suspect. And then also, She noted that she was unsure that the man in the picture, who she saw, was the same man which she identified. And at trial, she put this at about, she was only about 70% sure. Furthermore,
one of the other things in the social science literature, specifically remarked on by the Supreme Court last spring, is that measures of confidence have no relation whatever to the accuracy of identification. None. That's a particular point that the American Psychology Association told the Supreme Court it had completely misunderstood. Now, as I say, it may be good or it may be bad. We're supposed to consider that under the Supreme Court's test. But don't we have to know what the psychology literature is telling us about the weight of factors like that?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but there's another factor. Perhaps the psychology, more psychological evidence would have helped, Your Honor. However, another factor that happened at the suppression hearing shows that Ms. Mobles, in fact, failed to even identify Mr. Sanders in a photograph. And at the suppression hearing, the defense showed Ms. Mobles a picture which he said she saw at the currency exchange, which had Lamar Sanders standing between two individuals. And this is Exhibit 1B in the appendix. Ms. Mobles said she didn't recognize anybody in the pictures, and furthermore, that she could not even recognize whether the person in the picture, which Lamar Sanders, was a man or a woman. This inability to even recognize the defendant in a picture which he saw at the currency exchange goes to the reliability of her testimony. And again, to add to that, Ms. Noble's other identifications were tainted by this suggestive photo show-up. The photo lineup occurred mere hours later after this show-up and was tainted by showing just a stack of photos of the defendant to Mr. Sanders before she had six photos put in front of her. Then Ms. Sanders' testimony at trial was also tainted because of these two suggestive procedures. Now, as we described, it was not a harmless error to admit these identifications. Ms. Nobles was the main government witness. During trial, she testified to all three IDs. The government even recalled Ms. Nobles so that she could say she was, quote, 100% sure that it was Mr. Sanders who she saw. In closing arguments, the government responded to questions about the reliability of Ms. Nobles' identifications and told the jury, quote, don't be fooled, and assured them that, indeed, Ms. Nobles had, quote, identified Lamar Sanders. It's not clear beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have convicted Mr. Sanders. There were two alibi witnesses who said that Mr. Sanders was at his mother's house during the crime. There were also significant problems with the two witnesses by the government at trial who placed Mr. Sanders at the scene. We already discussed the first witness, Ms. Noble's 10-year-old daughter, who was either in a different room than the second suspect throughout the ordeal or partially blindfolded. The second witness, Ralph Scott, avoided a 20-year mandatory minimum by testifying against Mr. Sanders at trial and repeatedly changed his story to the police. And if there are no further questions, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Holler.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Judge Cudahy, you started the other side off with the harmless error argument. I would point out that in light of the fact that eyewitness identification looks to be a bit in flux in the Supreme Court, that if the Court did, for some reason, wish to duck the question, any error in this case on the identification was plainly harmless. The defendant attempts to argue that we did not put the phone in Mr. Sanders' hands, and that's essentially untrue. The evidence showed, and this is in the testimony of the FBI agent Pierce at pages 789 through 791, is a detailed description of the calls. The calls start in the south suburbs of Chicago. They travel to Portage, Indiana. They then travel to the vicinity of the currency exchange. The very last call that is made on that phone, still in the vicinity of the currency exchange, occurs at 9:24, about 9 minutes after Mr. Scott was arrested. That call was placed to Carlina Williams, who is the defendant's girlfriend, who lives in Arizona, who spent $20,000 on his legal defense. And she testified on pages 636 through 639 that she got a call. She was an OR nurse. She was in surgery, and she got a call from Mr. Sanders saying that the phone was either lost or stolen, and she needed to turn it off. And then we have the testimony of Samuel Martinez, who was a person from Verizon, at pages 674 through 679, who testifies as to the business records, which established the recorded phone call from Carlina Williams at 9:27, 3 minutes later, to Verizon to cut off the phone because it's lost or stolen. And then, in fact, that the phone is later reactivated with a changed number because, of course, it's not really lost or stolen. So the phone is in Mr. Sanders' hand, beyond any doubt, 9 minutes after the currency exchange robbery. And it's not where his alibi witnesses say it is in the south suburbs, where his mother testifies he's sleeping on the couch. So in addition to that, we have the testimony of R.E., of the little girl. The Supreme Court in Simmons, in footnote 6, said that when there is necessity to sort of go outside of the normal array procedure and show a photograph, that one thing that the Supreme Court suggested you do is to show the photograph to one witness and not to the other. And that's what the officers did here. They showed the photograph to Tamika Nobles. They didn't show it to R.E. They then had R.E. look at the array later, and she picked out Mr. Sanders. So when you combine all of that evidence with the fact that it's Sanders' car that's at the scene, that it's Sanders' wallet, which is at the scene, and that Mr. Scott, the co-defendant, testified that his best friend, Mr. Sanders, was the other robber, or the other kidnapper, excuse me, this is clearly a case of harmless error. Turning, though, to the merits, again, the Supreme Court, despite being asked by the American Psychological Association to reconsider its test, chose not to do so in Perry versus New Hampshire and said that, at least for the time being, this is the sequential two-part test that is to be followed. And under the first part of the test, the question is whether it was unnecessarily suggestive. As in Simmons, case we cited from the Supreme Court of Missouri in Kirksey, this was an urgent situation. There was a man armed with a 30-round clip on the loose. It is certainly true that Ari had escaped from or had been let go by Sanders, that she was in the currency exchange, but there is an armed man on the loose, and there is, under that circumstances, a necessity that the district court could rightly conclude that it was not unnecessary, that it was an exigent circumstance that justified the showing of these photos, even if they could be deemed in some way suggestive. The officers were still in the investigative stage. They were not trying to confirm a preconceived notion that some bank robber who's been apprehended with the money in the getaway car and is in handcuffs and is being paraded in front of the victims for no discernible reason. It's not that situation. It's a situation where the officers are attempting to decide, what do we do? We have a witness who says this man is 5'5" and is 250. We have a little girl who says that actually the robber's taller than that. And we have these photographs at the ready, and we have a car that doesn't belong to Mr. Scott. Is Mr. Sanders the other kidnapper, or is he an innocent friend who could be a critical witness in this case? They need to know that information, and under those circumstances, we don't believe that the first part of the test is met. If we turn to the second part of the test, again, Your Honors, the Supreme Court said in Manson versus Brathwaite that juries are not so susceptible that they cannot measure intelligently the weight of identification testimony that has some questionable feature. That's 432 U.S. at 116. And the interesting thing about the Supreme Court cases, Your Honors, is that if one looks at the pattern, Stovall versus Deno and Simmons and Manson versus Brathwaite, Neal versus Biggers, Perry versus New Hampshire, the one link in all of those is that the Supreme Court has let the eyewitness identification testimony in every single case and has said that the jury can decide. Now, certainly there are circumstances when there is undue suggestiveness, as in this court's case of Kossel versus Miller, where the officers are, over a course of 3 years, continually showing this person they think is the suspect to the witness, where this court did say, look, under the due process clause, this is just too much. This is just unduly suggestive. This is just unnecessary. We have no confidence in this identification. But outside of those extreme circumstances, the Supreme Court and this court have said juries are smart enough to figure this out. And that's what the district court said here. That was not a clearly erroneous decision on the part of the district court, and therefore that decision should be upheld. Again, Your Honors, we also don't think that there was any Ms. Nobles was shown a photo array later. She was asked to identify him in court. But the only arguments that the defendant has made as to why those later identifications are tainted or suggestive is because of the taint of the first photo array. And as I believe we've suggested, under neither prong of the test set forth initially in Neal versus Biggers and reaffirmed in Perry, would there have been justification for suppressing these photographs to the extent the court feels that there is any doubt on that point. Again, as we've already mentioned, we believe it should be harmless error. If the court has the defendant did not argue either of his other two points here. If the court has questions on those, I am more than happy to answer them. But we do not believe there was any abuse of discretion in excluding the fact that the witness's prior forgery conviction occurred at a currency exchange. We also don't believe that there really isn't any conflict between the two statutes in this particular case. This is not a case like Watt versus Alaska, where one federal statute says pay 75% of the funds received to the state, and the other statute says pay 10% of the funds received to the state. You can't do both if it's a single pot of money. You have to pick one or the other. Here, one statute says sentence him to a term greater than or equal to 20 years. One says sentence him to a term greater than or equal to 25 years. By picking any number, 25 or greater, both statutes can be reconciled with. To the extent that there is any discrepancy that the court views in those statutes, we believe that the statement in the statute saying that it should apply unless a greater mandatory minimum sentence is otherwise provided should be followed.
If they were completely incompatible?
In light of that sentence, I don't think they would.
In light of the governing law for resolving incompatibilities in criminal statutes, neither side seems aware that back in the 1970s, this court held exactly what Mr. Watkins is arguing about inconsistency in criminal statutes and that the lower penalty controls. Of course, it's also true that the Supreme Court reversed us 9-0.
Then I'll rely on that case, Your Honor, and stand on my brief for other points. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mm-hmm. Anything further, Mr. Watkins? The case, in case you're interested, is United States against Batchelder, 442 U.S. 114, 1979.
Your Honor, I do have two additional points to make. First, with regard to the call to Carlina Williams, Ms. Williams did testify that she received a call from Mr. Sanders sometime between 9 and 9:30. She did not, however, see what number that was from, and she cannot remember it. Mr. Sanders' phone had also called Mr. Sanders' house at 9:22 and 9:21. And this is where the two alibi witnesses said Mr. Sanders was at the time of the crime. A jury could reasonably conclude that the phone had accidentally called Mr. Sanders, he realized his phone was missing at that point, and that he, from a different number from the home, called Mrs. Williams. And that for some reason, there was also a separate call from the phone to Mrs. Williams. So that evidence that a phone call was made to Mrs. Williams by Mr. Sanders does not establish that there was any harmful error. And then second, there were no exigent circumstances here which justified a photo lineup, which justified an inherently suggestive photo show up. Everybody was safe. Ms. Noble's daughter was safe. And this court has held that mere convenience does not justify a photo show up, especially where a less suggestive photo identification could be arranged, like a photo lineup, which was in fact arranged by the FBI 2 hours later. Normal investigative demands, such as searching for a suspect, are not exigent circumstances. And with that, I would ask this court to reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Watkins. And the court appreciates your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement. The court